today by asking you something I've been asked to ask. How many of you have heard of the social experiment? The social experiment. Okay, a few. Okay, that's all I wanted to know. All right, so now we're going to continue with DNA synthesis. We explained last time how the template for DNA synthesis is used. We talked about the energy, and then we were talking about the enzymes involved in DNA replication. What are the features that arise because of their peculiarities? Now, you may remember that all polymerases, and this is true of DNA and RNA polymerases, all add to the 3' end. Now, it's not surprising that a polymerase will only add to one end or the other. If these are your two chains of DNA, let's just look at one. If this is the new nucleotide, it has a triphosphate end and it has a hydroxyl end. So does the chain. Now, if you have an enzyme that holds its substrates like this, you can't expect the same enzyme to hold a substrate by this end. So either the enzyme holds the substrate by this end and you grow this way, or you would think it would hold the substrate by this end and it would grow this way. Now, it turns out that all polymerases do it one of the two ways. They all add to the 3' end with the triphosphate pointing in. And we will talk a little bit next time about why perhaps this one and not that one. It has to do with the ability to correct mistakes. But for the time being, let's take it as a given that you have to add to the 3' end. So that leads to the problem that we discussed last time. That we know that you don't completely separate Watson and Crick, but you unzip it a little bit at a time. So we've drawn that up here. And I also have a model, a little piece of Velcro, that you don't unzip the whole thing and make a complement to that and a complement to that. That's not how it's done. Instead, you unzip a little bit at a time, as shown here in the first step. And then you make the complements, but now you have a problem because, as we've said, DNA polymerase can only grow chains in the one of the two directions. So, if we open up our DNA, and remember, not only do we always add to the 3' end, but the template and the new strand are always anti-parallel. So that means if we're going to make a complement, say, to this side, we can, since all arrows here are 5-3, we can synthesize in this direction, no problem. So we can make a new complementary chain. But on the other side, that's on the left there. But on the other side, this is, the chain goes this way, so we have to go this way. We have to start down here and synthesize in a retrograde direction. So I'll put something in. And then we unzip some more. And we get to, that stage isn't shown there. That would be stage 3 on your handout. And now it is possible to continue the synthesis of this chain. And in fact, I have a piece. I could just keep going continuously. In fact, all the way till I get to the end, basically. But I don't have that situation here. Here I have to start a new chain back here. So I have to have what is called discontinuous synthesis. First I make this piece, and then I back up and make that piece. And that's the result that's shown there at the end of 3 and 4. Now, we explained last time that you don't just keep this up because there's an additional feature, that there is an enzyme that joins the two ends here on the so-called lagging strand enzyme joins these two short pieces. And that enzyme is called ligase. Now, on the other hand, for the leading strand, there is no problem. Synthesis, adding to the 3' end, can simply continue. And these short pieces, which are 100 to 1,000 bases long, are known as Okazaki fragments after their discoverer. But they are all joined up shortly after they are made. Now, if this were all there were to it, then you could take DNA as a template, nucleoside, deoxynucleoside triphosphates as substrate, and you could take all the enzymes we talked about, DNA polymerase, pyrophosphatase, ligase, plus all the enzymes to unwind everything, which we're ignoring. You could put that all in a test tube, and your DNA would get replicated. But if you put all that in a test tube, nothing happens, because we left something out. It turns out that in addition to the properties which we mentioned, which are true of all polymerases, DNA polymerase has the property that it cannot start a new chain. It can only add to a loose 3' end. As we will see, RNA polymerase can get started, but DNA polymerase cannot. And this also is related to its ability to correct mistakes. Now, what difference does all of that make? That's why you have steps 5 and 6 on your handout, which I skipped last time, and why I didn't put ligase in yet. So both on your handout, we can draw it, and I can demonstrate what's going on. So when you actually get through step, what you really need to start synthesis, DNA polymerase can add, but it can't start. So in order to get started, you have to put in first a little bit of a short strand. And then DNA polymerase can add to it. And this short strand is called a primer. And the enzyme that synthesizes it, that hooks the nucleotides together, is called primase. Now, if DNA polymerase can't start, how can this start? Primase is a type of RNA polymerase. So that RNA, the primer is made of RNA, not DNA. So we have a very short RNA section, maybe 20 bases or less, and then DNA polymerase takes over. So you notice there's a little dot on your handout. That's meant to symbolize the primer. So strictly speaking, you have to have primer first. Okay, primer, primer, primer. Now, before we talked about ligase, connecting these two ends. But we don't want any RNA in the DNA when we get finished. When we get finished, we want the lagging strand to be a continuous DNA strand. So what do we have to get rid of? The primer. We're going to have to want to get rid of this section. So in fact, you notice what step 5 is that you remove the primer. Now, I've left the primers on the other end for now. But this primer from the very first Okazaki fragment is removed. It is digested. Well, can I join those two ends? I have to do something else first. I have to fill in the gap. Now, which way are we going to fill in the gap? Top to bottom or bottom to top? We have to think about 5' and 3' and all that. So what's what? All these arrows go 5' to 3'. So this is a 5' end. What's this? Is this a 5 or a 3 prime? This is a 3 prime end. So which end can we add to? If DNA polymerase, either the same or another one, comes back, can it add to either end? It can actually add here. So DNA polymerase in step 6 fills in the gap. But you notice the gap isn't, so the gap is not going to be the discontinuous point here, ready to be hooked by ligase, is not going to be here, but up there. Okay? So we filled in this little piece. And now ligase can come along in step 7 and make the join. And now we have G. Which is okay. And now we have to unzip some more and do it again. So if we unzip some more, we're going to have the equivalent of the end of step 3. And then we're going to put in some more short pieces. So let's demonstrate how this goes with the Velcro. So it wasn't right to start like this. I had to have primer first. So before we could put any DNA in at all, any new DNA, we have to have a little primer, hook up a little bit of RNA with the primase enzyme. And now DNA polymerase can take over, add to the 3' end, and we can keep going. So this would be the so-called leading strand, continuous, except for the primer. But what happens on the other side? We couldn't start here without primer. So we should have had a short primer followed by, I have to get my geometry right. We had a short primer, and then DNA polymerase took over, and we continued up to the end. Well, it overlaps, but it should be right up to the end. And then how are we going to make the next piece? We have to have a primer down here. And then DNA polymerase can take over. And we can fill in. But now the problem is, remember we have to get rid of the primer? So we're going to digest this away. And now DNA polymerase is going to fill in the hole. And ligase is going to join it. Now, what does the destruction of the primer? I've written it here as if it was two separate steps, and in some cases it may be. But we think most of the time it's actually the same enzyme that does both. And it's actually DNA polymerase, one of them, that does both. There may be more than one DNA polymerase here, but we are lumping them together, and in some organisms there is, I think, one. They all have certain properties in common, and that all of them are able to add to the 3' end. They catalyze polymerization. Always, as we've said, in the 3' to 5' direction. But these are big, complicated enzymes. And big enzymes can have multiple subunits, and each subunit can have a different catalytic activity. So some DNA polymerases, I think actually all of them, also have the ability to degrade DNA from the 5' end. So that's called 5' to 3' exonuclease. Nuclease means it chews up nucleic acid, cuts off one mononucleotide at a time. Exo means it does it from the end, not from the middle. And 5 to 3 means it starts on the 5' end. Now, what do we need that for? Our primer had to be chewed off from its 5' end. So the idea here is that you have a single enzyme, and the front end is catalyzing the removal of primer, It is acting as an exonuclease. And the back end is acting as polymerase to elongate the piece behind. This is a little like an old-fashioned steam engine with a cow catcher. So as it goes along, it clears off the track, and it pulls the cars behind. So that's what's going on here. This one complex enzyme is doing both. Now, as we will see later, some DNA polymerases have an additional ability. Some of them also have a 3' to 5' exonuclease. You might ask, what on earth is this for? This turns out to be for correcting mistakes, as we will explain later. So let me see if I forgot anything that I wanted to add here. Oh, yes. Now, what happens if you replicate DNA like we've been saying? Okay, so when you get to the end, this end has only one primer. For the discontinuous chain, there would actually be one primer here left. All the rest of it would have been synthesized and joined up. So this would now all be continuous. The enzyme that removes primer from its 5' end, well, here's a loose 5' end, so it can chew off the primer. Chop, 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 no primer. But now, how are we going to fill in the hole? How do you normally fill in the hole? Well, you have a loose 3' end, and you just extend it up to the back end. This is the easiest to see. Where is a loose 3' end to add to fill this up? There isn't. Now, it turns out that bacteria and viruses solve the problem because their DNA is almost always circular. Now, how does that help? If it's circular, we have a 3' end right here, and we can just fill it in. No sweat. Your chromosomes, on the other hand, and those of most eukaryotes, are linear. And therefore, you have a problem. How are you going to fill this in? And the answer is sometimes you don't. And so your chromosomes get shorter as they are replicated. Now, we think most of the time it may not make any difference. However, sometimes they may get too short and it may matter. Now, why doesn't it matter if they get shorter? Because they have a special section on the end, which is just repeated spacer. And if you cut it off, so what? It's only if you get short enough to cut into genes and information that it makes any difference. And those special ends on linear chromosomes are called telomeres. And in some cases, you can put them back on and grow your chromosomes up to normal length. That, for example, happens when you make gametes, eggs and sperm, so everything starts with full-length telomeres. And the enzyme that grows them back up to length is called telomerase. Now, we're not going to talk any more about telomeres and telomerase, but I've told you the term, so if you want to go look it up, if you're interested, you may. And the 2009 Nobel Prize in Medical Science was given to the people who identified telomeres and telomerase. And if you go to the Nobel Prize site, where there's a link in your notes, it will tell you, you can find all about it. We will talk about it a little more next semester when we focus on eukaryotes. Now, we've already mentioned the part in the notes about DNA polymerase having three possible activities. The idea that you could have a complex enzyme where each part or subunit or domain had a different activity. And the possibilities are listed here: polymerase, exonuclease from the 3' and from the 5'. Now, when you first hear about this, exonuclease sounds like the reverse of polymerase. I grow the chain, I cut it back. But they're not the same. These are not the reverse of the polymerase. Because what would be the reverse of polymerase? It would be to knock off a nucleotide monophosphate, add pyrophosphate, and put it back together again. These do not add back pyrophosphate. They just hydrolyze the bonds by adding water. So when you synthesize, this is a triphosphate. And when you add it on, you knock off two phosphates. When you do exonuclease, you break this bond, but you don't add back the diphosphates. You just leave this as a monophosphate. And that's a different reaction. Now there's one more feature of DNA replication that I wanted to talk about. This is on the bottom, actually, of your handout 11.3. The way we've been describing it, especially if you have linear chromosomes, well, it looks like what you do is you start with something double-stranded. And you unzip it a little bit at a time. And that, in fact, is what you do when you have linear molecules. You unzip a little bit, and then more, and then more. But with circular molecules, there is no end. So how do you replicate them? Well, the answer is you start in the middle. In fact, with linear ones, you do it too. But it's more obvious with a circular one. There's no place to start except in the middle. So there's some special place where it always starts. And that's called the origin of DNA replication. So let's say this is where the origin is. So what happens is you open it up. And you see that little bubble on the bottom of your handout. Now, we just explained how a fork works, how you unzip the linear end and keep going. So actually what's going to happen is you have one of those forks starting here. So DNA replication is going to go around. Continuous synthesis on one side, discontinuous on the other. But now there's another fork going in the opposite direction. And it's continuous on one side, discontinuous on the other. So the picture you see there of bidirectional replication, which looks sort of like this. So the left half, if we turn it 90 degrees, is the fork like on the top. And the right half, if we turn it 90 degrees, is like the fork on the top. But you have two forks. And so DNA replication goes around this way, and it goes around the other way, until eventually the two meet at the end. And we have now two double-stranded circles instead of one. And that is how DNA replication is thought to work. Now, you notice that it's drawn out on the bottom of your handout, but it's not labeled. So I want you to try an exercise with your partner to be sure you understand what's going on. If you look at the third picture over, it looks sort of like this. Because there's a right fork and a left fork. So let's just focus on the left fork here. And we have two little Okazaki fragments that I'll call A and B. So I want to ask you, which of these was made first? A or B? So what I'd like you to do is sit there for a minute and put on all the 5' and 3' and tell me the answer. So don't try it by yourself. Talk to the person next to you. You get a couple of minutes to give it a shot. ask somebody. Is we'll take a vote, and not to bias the outcome, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes again. So how many people think A was made first? How many people think B? How many people think it's too early in the morning to make up your mind? Okay, we got a bunch of those. Okay, so you can open your eyes. So some people think A, and some people think B. So would somebody care to defend A? You don't have to have said it. Why A? Brave soul here, tell me why A? I could be nasty and call on you, but instead I will ask somebody to defend B. Somebody tell me why it's B. Okay?
Well, since the diameter is biggest in the middle, it probably ends up starting in the middle.
Since the diameter is bigger in the middle, it probably ends up starting in the middle. So what you're saying is this is the origin. Okay, so that's the first step. That's the origin. But by it starting in the middle, you still have a fork this way and a fork that way. So when the fork goes this way, but the direction of synthesis of this piece was which way? Like the arrow says, the piece went this way. But did we start from this end? Or the arrow? We actually had to make this one retrograde. We had to start here with a primer and make B, and then back up to A and make a primer and start here. So in fact, which of these ends, is this the 5 or the 3 prime end? I hear 5 and I hear 3. Which way is it growing? It always grows 5 to 3. So this has to be 5, and this has to be 3, because we had to add on this way as we went. Now what you should do as an exercise when you get home is you should put all the 5 primes and 3 primes on this picture. And be sure you can follow why it goes the way it goes. And if you can do that, you got it licked. So which of these was made first? C was, because notice on this side, the top is discontinuous lagging strand, and on the bottom, it's the other one. So let me stop here and ask what questions you have before we go on. Yeah?
How does the DNA polymerase now just stop replacing nucleic acids?
How does DNA polymerase know to stop chewing so you don't destroy everything? I think the answer probably is it prefers RNA to DNA. So once it's chewed off all the RNA, aka primer, it stops. Yeah?
We have it like laid out sequentially, but is it actually more or less happening all at once? Or is it really happening discreetly in steps? Like obviously some parts need to come before others, but you know, does it keep on zipping?
Is all of this happening sequentially or all at once? And I would say sort of all at once, but certain, as you say, certain things have to happen first. So the zipper is very gradually moving down constantly. Is there a slight pause in between? I couldn't tell you. So somebody probably knows. Yes?
What determines the length of the Okazaki?
What determines the length of the Okazaki fragment? And I don't know the answer to that. Yes, in the back?
What's so special about the spot that's the origin?
What's special about the spot that's the origin? So that's a good question. Why would DNA replication start there? In order to do DNA replication, what do you have to do? You have to unwind the DNA, you have to assemble all the proteins, enzymes. You need a whole bunch of proteins to stick to that part of the DNA.
So there's something special about that sequence that attracts the unfolding and replication enzymes. So you can think of it actually as a binding, if we ignore everything else. The origin is a binding site for DNA polymerase. That's where the DNA polymerase complex sits down and starts. One more.
I don't understand the loose end problem. So if you can do 5 to 3 exonuclease, why do you have a loose end problem?
If you can do 5 to 3 exonuclease, you can remove the last primer, but you can't replace it. Because you can only, once you replicate this thing, there's going to be a little piece of primer here, and then one continuous strand. Then you're going to chew off the primer. But now, this little piece will not have a complement. Exonuclease only allows you to remove from the 5' end. It doesn't allow you to add to the 5' end.
You said it's done by the exonuclease. It's not an actual enzyme. It's part of the polymerase, right?
It is part of the polymerase, but the
polymerase continue on? Can't the polymerase keep making more?
No, because the back end of the polymerase can only add nucleotides if it has a loose 3' end. So there's no engine, there's no chain, there's no train behind this engine.
Okay?
All right. So before we go on, I realize I forgot to say something about this model. I promised you last time I would bring this because it shows the phenomenon of base stacking. This shows this is a base pair, this is a base pair, this is a base pair. And this shows very clearly that the base pairs are relatively flat and they're piled up on top of each other so that you have a weak interaction this way, up and down, as well as the hydrogen bonds, which are across here, and so forth. Now, this also shows pretty well the anti-parallel nature of the two strands, because this red dot represents the oxygen in the ring of the sugar, of the deoxyribose. So you notice on this side, all the oxygens point out, up, and on this side, all the oxygens point down. And if you look more closely, it's quite clear that there's a difference in the orientation of the two sides. And you're welcome to come up and look at this afterwards. Now, one of the reasons for going into this primer business is that the need for primer has allowed us to make a very, very useful laboratory application of DNA synthesis. And this is called PCR, or the polymerase chain reaction. And for this, you're going to need 12A. Now, this idea is one which was invented by Cary Mullis, and he received the Nobel Prize for that in 1993. He claims he got the idea traveling on the Coast Highway of California under the influence of some drug or other. It is quite a good idea, a wild idea, but on the other hand, it's one of those ideas that when a molecular biologist hears it, they think, oh, why didn't I think of it? He thought of it, but others at the company where he worked out the practical details. But it turns out to be a really, really useful technology. And so that's why we're going to talk about it, because anytime anybody does anything these days, they use PCR. Now, the idea of PCR is, unlike with regular DNA synthesis, if you look at the top of your handout, I forgot my colored chalk today, but you have, so to speak, Watson and Crick, which we've distinguished here by making them thick and thin. That normally you unzip a little bit at a time, but in polymerase chain reaction, you denature the whole thing. So step one is to denature the DNA. Now that means that you can make the complement to Watson continuously from the appropriate spot, and you can make the complement to Crick
continuously from the appropriate spot. You don't have to deal with this fork business and discontinuous synthesis. So that means that you have continuous synthesis on both sides. That is, the complement to Watson is made continuously and the complement to Crick. Now, the trick is to start synthesis and to copy the part that you want. DNA is extremely long. And so people had a very hard time if they wanted to look at, say, this section. How would they get many copies of that section when the DNA has lots and lots of other stuff in it? So the idea here is to copy just this section and ignore the rest. And Mullis realized that you could do that by adding the right primer. Because primer determines where you're going to start. Now, in a living cell, there are other factors that determine where primase will begin and where you will have primer. But in PCR conditions, you add preformed primer. You don't use an enzyme to make it. You make it in a laboratory, and you use DNA primer, not RNA. It's short and preformed. Now, since it's DNA, we're not going to have to remove it. In the end, wherever it is just fine. Now, what does primer have to do with it? If I were to denature this DNA, and let's just look at Crick. If I do DNA synthesis, where will I start? It depends on what primer I have. If I have a primer that hybridizes here, and now I add DNA polymerase, what will it do? DNA polymerase can't start by itself, right? But it can add to which end? The 3'. So everything's anti-parallel, so this is the 3' end. So now if I add DNA polymerase, it will go to the end. And it will skip all of this. And if you look at your handout, that's what cycle one is. So in cycle one, first you denature the DNA to give you B. And then you add primer, which is complementary to one end of your target sequence, which is what you call this. Now, we're just going to follow Crick. We're going to ignore Watson because an equivalent thing is happening to Watson. So now, if we add DNA polymerase, so step one is you denature. Step two is you add primer. And it hybridizes wherever its complement is. And you have designed the primer to stick where you want. Now you add DNA polymerase. And polymerase will continue all the way to the end. Now that allowed you to skip the part on the top you weren't interested in, but you still copied the part on the bottom. But now you repeat it. This is the end of cycle one. This is the stage we've called E. Now you notice there's no stage called C, because I reserved C for the Watson-Crick business. Now, let's do it again. That's cycle two. So what does do it again mean? We're going to denature, add primer, add DNA polymerase. So if we denature, and remember, we're just following Crick, we're going to get these two. Now, what's this one going to do? It's going to do exactly the same thing over again. So we're going to ignore it. This is the thing that's different. It's longer than we want, but it's missing the top. But now we add the primer to the other end. We add a different primer because we've made the complement of Crick. This is really a Watson. So now we add the black primer.
which is in G. I'm going to put it here. But after we add the primer now, we can add DNA polymerase. What will DNA polymerase do? It's going to build from?
3 to 5.
From, well, it's going to add to the 3 prime end. So now for this little piece here, which is which? Are we going to synthesize up or down? You can cheat and look at your handout. We're going to synthesize up because this is the 3 prime end, so we're going to add from here. And this gives us the end of cycle 2 in the thing I've called H. Now notice, the first time we skipped the top that we weren't interested in. The second time we skipped the bottom that we weren't interested in. And this little piece on the left here, this is exactly the length of our target sequence. No top, no bottom. But it's still attached to a piece that's too long. So now we do it one more time, cycle 3. So what happens in cycle 3 is we denature it again. Now what's going to happen to this one on the right? It's going to go back up to here and do it again. So we're going to ignore it. But our new thing is this. This piece is the right length, but it has no partner. How can we get it the right length partner? We need a primer, a DNA polymerase. But a primer, as the primer we want is the same sequence as the one we started with. We need another copy of it, but it's the same sequence. So this actually is complementary to the primer, to the sequence we want, and we add DNA polymerase, and we end up with a double-stranded molecule that's the right length. And that's the end of cycle 3. Now, we didn't go through it, but Watson was doing the equivalent thing, making a complement without one part, making a complement without the other part, and then making a complement. So at the end of cycle 3, you have two molecules like this, the length that you wanted, double-stranded, and nothing else. But what if you repeat it again? If I have one of these, and I do denature, add primer, and add DNA polymerase, I'll get 2 of these. And then I'll get 4 if I do it again. And then I'll get 8, and then I'll get 16. So in future cycles, this will be copied exponentially. And pretty soon, I will have a huge pile of these, which is exactly what I wanted. Now, I will have a few more of these medium-length pieces, but they increase only linearly, while the pieces I want increase exponentially. And this is not obvious. There's some problems in the problem book to help you see how this works. But the basic point is you end up with many, many of these. Many, many double-stranded copies of the part you were interested in, the so-called target sequence. Yes?
For cycle 3, you reuse the primer from cycle 1.
For cycle 3, do you reuse the primer from cycle 1? Well, you cannot, because that primer is already part of a new DNA strand. This primer is the same sequence as the one used in cycle 1, but it's another molecule of it. Now, the way this sounds like the way you have to do it, and the way it was done originally, was to take the template, denature it, add primer, add DNA polymerase. Well, you denature it means you heat it. To hybridize, you cool it down, you let the polymerase chug along, and then you did it again. And each time you heated it up to denature it, what do you think happened to the DNA polymerase? What happens when you heat most enzymes? Clunk, permanent denaturation. So you had to keep adding it after every cycle. And then Mullis actually had the idea of getting a heat-resistant DNA polymerase. They actually isolated it from bacteria that live in hot springs. So they use not regular DNA polymerase, but heat-resistant. Now the advantage of that is you can mix everything together at the beginning. You mix template DNA. What else do you need?
Primer.
If you're going to make DNA, you need nucleoside, deoxynucleoside triphosphate. So you need the triphosphates to link together. You need the template DNA. You need many, many primers, many copies of each primer. Now, how many different primers did we use here? Actually, only two. One to Watson that fit here, so you could grow this way. One to Crick that start here, so you could go this way. And one that hybridized to Watson, so you could grow that way. So there's only two different primers, but you need many, many copies of all of both of them. Yes?
How long are the primers?
How long are the primers? I think they're about 20 nucleotides. So you can actually add deoxy-XTP, template, heat-resistant polymerase, multiple copies of the primer, and you mix it all together. And then you heat it, cool it, heat it, cool it, heat it, cool it. Each time you heat it, it starts a new cycle. You denature your DNA. Then when you cool it down, the primer hybridizes to the template. The DNA polymerase adds on until it gets to the end. Then you heat it up again, it denatures, and you do it again. You don't have to keep adding things. You just have now automatic machines or cyclers that heat it up, cool it down, heat it up, cool it down, heat it up, cool it down. And this process allows you then to make as many copies as you would like of a given sequence. And in theory, how many copies do you need to start with? One. In practical terms today, you need, I think, about 10 to 50 is the usual number. Yes?
Without knowing what the target section expresses, how do you know what section you're actually interested in?
Okay, so his question really is, how do you know what section you want to copy so to make the right primers? I think that's your question. The real answer is, you have to isolate this DNA once and get its actual sequence so you know what primers to use. But once you've done it once, now you can amplify it and all its relatives anywhere. And how you actually isolate this once is a process called DNA cloning, and we'll talk about that later. Now, how is this used practically? One of the uses is barcoding, which we read about on the very first day I gave you an article about figuring out which fish was in the sushi, that kind of thing. And the way you do that is you have primers to a particular section of the DNA, which is similar in all living things, and you amplify that section of the DNA, and then you sequence it. You get the actual sequence of bases, and it varies a little bit from species to species, so you can tell where, what species it came from. And that's how they found out the so-called white tuna was tilapia. So there, you amplify a known coding sequence, actually sequence it, and compare. Now, one of the biggest uses of this, of course, is in forensics. And the article from the first day of today, in fact, explains a little bit of how it's used for that. We're not going to go through it now, but you can read it when you get home, but I'll explain what the point is. With forensics, also, you amplify a known section of the DNA. Usually, though, you do not sequence that section of the DNA. Instead, you measure how long it is. Now, the trick to this is that the sections of the DNA that they amplify for forensic purposes are sections that differ in length from person to person. And the reason is they're sections of the DNA that have what are called short tandem repeats, or STRs. Short tandem repeats. That means they have some sequence like AAGCT, and it's just repeated over and over and over again. You have sections of your DNA like this for unknown reasons. They'll have a safe sequence and then the same sequence again and again and again. That means tandem. Now, the point of short tandem repeats is that the number of repeats varies from person to person. It's always in here, so that this section and this section flanking it are always the same. So you can use primers to the flanking section, and that will they will copy the repeats, and then you measure how long the piece is. The piece that you amplified, the length will depend on the number of repeats. So what they do is they amplify 13 regions of your DNA, which are known to have short tandem repeats. And then they compare the lengths of those, the DNA derived from those 13 sections. And that varies enormously from person to person. They write down in their database the lengths of those 13 sections. Now, it's a little more complicated because you are all diploid. You all have two copies of genetic information, one from your mother, one from your father. So you have, at each of those 13 places, two copies. So what they write down in the database for the FBI is 26 numbers. How long was your mother's version here? How long was your dad's version here? And the same. And because they pick 13 very variable places and 26 numbers, the pattern of numbers they get is essentially unique to every individual. As we said before, except for your identical twin. So what they do is they scrape the DNA off the floor or from under somebody's fingernails. They amplify the DNA and they find out the type, the length of the repeats at each of that 13 sections from that sample. Then they take a suspect, they take the suspect's DNA, they amplify it, and they look at the size of the 13 sections. If the two do not match, that's called an exclusion. That means that person did not leave his or her DNA behind, and that's very strong evidence that that person did not do it. And that's the basis of the Innocence Project and all the articles you read about people who've been in prison who have been exonerated. Their DNA was finally tested, it was compared to the DNA at the scene of the crime, and they did not match. And if they don't match, the person is excluded and off the hook. On the other hand, if they do match, that does not prove that the person, that's called an inclusion, and it doesn't mean that the person who did it and the person whose DNA you have are the same. But since they match in every respect you can measure, it is very, very, very unlikely that somebody else did it. It is essentially, that's why people call it a DNA fingerprint, because this pattern of 26 numbers is essentially unique to everybody in the world. So you either have to argue they made a mistake, you have an identical twin, or it's just improbable. But since it's something like 1 in a billion, you're in big, it's not a good argument. Okay, so when DNA is done right, it is an extremely useful and reliable tool. And in fact, in today's paper, they have an article about somebody who developed a DNA spray so that if you try and rob McDonald's, the machine in the doorway sprays you with DNA. And each McDonald's has a different DNA spray. So they not only can catch you, but they can figure out where you did it. So far, they haven't caught anybody with this, but it has, in fact, cut down on crime enormously. Because people are afraid they'll get caught. Yeah?
What are these sections that are known to have a lot of STRs?
Repeats? They are generally in spacers, mostly between genes, but sometimes in introns. But the point is, these are not the sections of your DNA that code for your proteins that make you you. One of the most interesting things is that the part of your DNA, which as far as you know is useless, is used to identify you almost perfectly. Any other questions about this? Yeah.
So you're saying these 13 regions are specific regions for everybody that are on the DNA that they're looking at?
These are the same 13 regions in everybody. Everybody has this region in the sense that everybody has this sequence and this sequence. And then everybody has a variable number of repeats in between. Yes?
Back in PCR, I don't understand why that at the end of cycle
three,
two. It's not. That's when you get the strand of the correct one.
Yes. At the end of cycle one, you have skipped this part that you didn't want. But you haven't skipped this part that you didn't want. In order to skip this part, you have to do another cycle where you start here and go up with a different primer. There's one primer for Watson and one primer for Crick, but you need many copies of each. Okay. All right. Now, we've talked a great deal about DNA, and for the remainder of the class today, I want to talk about RNA. We have alluded to RNA many times, but we have never really looked at it in detail. Now, since we spent, let's sort of describe first what you need RNA for, and then we'll consider sort of what it is. I think I may have mentioned earlier that there is something called the central dogma of molecular biology. This was invented by Crick, who, as I also mentioned before, is extremely anti-religious, and I think he invented it as a joke, but it's caught on. And the statement of it is just that DNA makes RNA, and RNA makes protein. But the way you can summarize that is that if you have DNA, we say DNA makes RNA, meaning that one of these strands is template to make RNA. So this is the DNA. This is the RNA. And then the point being, if you want to make protein, although the information is contained in the DNA, you don't use the DNA directly. You make an RNA corresponding to the section that you want to make protein from. And then this RNA is used as a template to line up the amino acids and make protein. Now, so we say DNA makes RNA, and RNA makes protein. Now, this RNA is a special kind of RNA called messenger, or mRNA for short. This contains the information that was in the DNA, which will allow you to line up the amino acids. But to do each of these processes, you need other stuff. We've discussed here the information part. This is a way of saying that the information goes from DNA to RNA to protein. But to do anything, to make a macromolecule, you need a template. But you also need to worry about energy issues. How are you going to drive it? Usually in some way with ATP. And also, to do these, you need something else. You need, of course, the raw materials. You need the nucleotides to link up. You need the amino acids to link up, and then you need some ATP to provide the energy to run it, etc. But do you need anything else? It's the usual magic word, enzymes. You can't do this without enzymes. So just as you need DNA polymerase for replication to make more DNA, along with primase, pyrophosphatase, unfolding enzymes, etc., you need RNA polymerase to carry out what is called transcription. Now, to line up the amino acids actually requires a huge number of proteins, some of which act as enzymes, and some of which act more to hold it together. So, this process is usually called translation. And in addition to needing the appropriate enzymes and proteins, you need additional types of RNA to carry this out. So everything requires proteins. But this also requires what's called transfer RNA,
or tRNA, and ribosomal RNA, or rRNA. Exactly what these are, how they work, etc., we will return to. So when people say DNA makes RNA and RNA makes protein, the RNA is important as a template for the protein, but it's also necessary as one of the tools, because you need the transfer RNA, there's an S in here, you need the transfer RNA to hold the amino acids and line them up, and you need ribosomal RNA as part of the ribosome just to hold the whole thing together. And we'll discuss all of those in detail. Now, what this says then is that DNA is transcribed to make messenger RNA. It's also transcribed to make these other kinds. And then these RNAs with the appropriate proteins allow you to translate and make the protein. Now, this sort of summarizes molecular biology, because we've got transcription, translation, replication, and maybe we'll put in one more thing. The protein does the job, and that sort of says it all. But, of course, some of the job of that protein is to catalyze these other steps. So this does have a chicken and the egg quality. There is no question about it. That you need protein to do this, and you need this to make protein. Now, let me just say briefly, in terms of terminology, that some people use the term translation to mean the whole shebang from DNA to protein. But usually, and that's the way we'll use it in this class, translation is just used for the second half, because going from DNA to RNA, you're in the same language, so to speak. You're talking nucleic acids. And that's different from going from RNA to protein, which requires a change from the nucleotide sequence to the amino acid sequence. And so that's what we're going to call translation. Now, before we go any further, yes?
Can one section of DNA that creates one, that transcribes into one RNA, also have like an overlapping piece of DNA that's used to transcribe to a different?
Her question is really about, does each section of the DNA uniquely code for a particular RNA? And the answer is usually yes. There are very rare cases of overlap, mostly involving viruses. What we're going to do now, before we go any further, is I want to ask you to think about something and maybe discuss it with your neighbor, and not to look at your notes for a minute, because the answer happens to be in there. How many differences can you think of between DNA and RNA? How long a list can you come up with? So you have about a minute or two on this one. It's not very hard. And then we'll check it out to be sure we got them all. One. So let me ask this time, I'm going to actually pick on somebody. So in the red scarf, what's the difference? You can blame your partner. An extra, actually extra hydroxyl, extra oxygen. So one difference is the sugar. The sugar in DNA is deoxyribose, which has an H on the 2' position, and in RNA it's ribose, which has an OH on the 2' position. So that's one. Do you have one? You.
RNA is single-stranded and the
DNA double-stranded?
RNA is single-stranded, and DNA is double-stranded. Now, it is true that some RNA is single but folded back on itself. But basically, yes, it is single-stranded, and it corresponds to one section of the DNA. So it is the complement of either Watson or Crick. This time I'll ask for a volunteer because it's getting harder.
They use different amino acids, or non-amino acids, whatever the name is. Sorry, I forgot.
So what would you? What are they called?
Guanines. Tyrosine.
So what are those things?
Bases,
not tyrosine. Thymine. Tyrosine is amino acid. So they use different bases. So that's a good one. So the bases are different, but actually three of them are the same. The purines are the same, G and A, but the pyrimidines are different. So with DNA, what are the two of them? They're thymine and cytosine, and you can get by with in this class with just knowing the letters. G, A, T, and C. You have to know what, when you see one, which it is. But you don't have to know the full names to write them out. So with RNA, though, the only one that's different is instead of T, you have U. And this difference, as you may remember, is one methyl group. There's a methyl on a T, which is a hydrogen on U. And these are not in the part that affect hydrogen bonding and pairing, but on the other side. There is one other difference I think we should put up here. And it follows actually from that picture. If I did this right, this would be much longer in this direction and much longer in this direction. DNA is generally extremely long, and RNA, relatively speaking, is short. It's still a big macromolecule, but it's not as long as the whole DNA usually from which it came. The RNA usually corresponds only to a shorter section, which is known as a gene. The actual definition of gene, to make a foolproof definition of gene, takes about a page. But to make an approximate one is not hard. So the DNA is very long, and the RNA is relatively short, corresponding to one or a few genes worth. So I wanted to first go over the difference in structure. And now consider, we really want to talk about how you make RNA. But we spent a huge amount of time discussing how you make DNA. So the easiest way to do it is just to compare how does the synthesis of RNA compare to that of DNA. And before we do that, though, I want to say just a little bit more, looking at the notes here to be sure I didn't forget anything, a little bit more about the different kinds of RNA and what you need them for. We've explained that transfer and ribosomal are sort of like the hardware, and messenger RNA is sort of the software that tells you which protein to make, how to line up the amino acids. And the question always is, why bother to make messenger RNA at all? Why not just read off the original DNA? Well, one answer is the one on the bottom. DNA is very long and unwieldy. And I actually only need the information in a very short section of it. So it's much more convenient to Xerox, so to speak, the page that I want and put the book back. Or to print out the web page that I want and close the site. I don't have to deal with all the rest of it. So that's one answer. Convenience is one. Another is maybe you'd call it security, or trying to preserve the DNA. The DNA is the master. We don't want to mess with it. If we actually work with it directly to make protein, it might get damaged. On the other hand, if we make a Xerox copy and work with that, we don't care. Because at the end, we can throw away the Xerox and we still have the master. So you can take your Xerox home. You can work on your paper, you can get coffee stains on it, and then you, when you're all done, you can crumple it up and throw it in the trash. And that's, in fact, what cells do. They make RNA, messenger RNA, they use it one or many times, and then they degrade it back to nucleotides, they recycle it, and make new RNA. So cells make new messenger RNA to suit the moment and to make whatever they need at the time. So one of them is to sort of save the master. And the last one is flexibility. And if you want to look at your other handout, 12B, you'll notice that we have at the top, well, sort of in the middle, we have a little picture of a section of the DNA. And I'm saying, suppose it has three genes in it, A, B, and C. If we use the DNA directly, we would have one copy of the template for A, one for B, and one for C. Suppose we want to make a lot of the protein, say, from B, but not too much from A or from C. Well, by making RNA first, messenger RNA, if you want to make a lot of protein B, you can make many copies of the messenger RNA, and you can translate them all simultaneously. So you can make lots of B at once. While if you don't want to make as much C, you only make a few copies of C and maybe only one of A. So this means that we will be able to synthesize the corresponding proteins to A, B, and C at different rates. Even though we have an equal number of copies of the master, we have different copies, numbers of Xeroxes, and many workers, so to speak, can read the B information all at the same time, and we can make B much faster. So this provides for flexibility in terms of making different proportions of the various proteins. It also means that if I want to make a lot of A today, I make many copies of the RNA for A. And if I don't want to make any A today, I don't bother. So it allows for flexibility in many directions. But then, how do you make RNA? RNA is very similar to DNA. Shorter, has U instead of C. But it has the same basic structure of nucleotides linked to each other, and they're all linked from the 3' prime of this one to the 5' prime of that. So there's a 5' prime end and a 3' prime end, and let's say AGU. So these would be ribose instead of deoxy, U instead of T, and shorter but and single, but very similar. So the way you grow RNA is the same way you grow DNA. You use a different enzyme, and you use a triphosphate just the same way. And of course, you always need a template, just as you do for DNA. So there would have to be a template here. Suppose this is A. If this is a DNA template, what goes here, T or U? This would be T because it's a DNA template, but we're making RNA. So that's why we have U here. So we would use a triphosphate in exactly the same way. If we wanted to add on a nucleotide, we would knock off a pyrophosphate and then hydrolyze it to get the energy to drive the addition of a new nucleotide. So both for DNA and RNA here, it says same for both. Growth of new change, 5' prime to 3' prime. Hey, what about parallel, anti-parallel? Which is the 5' prime end of this template? Are these parallel or anti-parallel? They have to, it's always anti-parallel. So this has to be 3' prime, 5' prime. And we've done the same idea, same way of growth. We're going to need the right polymerase and pyrophosphatase to get this to work. Now, clearly what's different is you use the ribose version. You use the U version instead of T. And you use RNA polymerase instead of DNA polymerase. And you can see that you make, when you carry out transcription, you get single-stranded product. When you carry out replication, short single-stranded. When you carry out replication, You're going to get a complete copy, full-length, double-strand. So what we're going to do next time is I want you to bring back 12B, and we're going to look some more at the other features. What are the significant differences between making DNA and RNA? Then we'll consider how you use the RNA.